ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
All my life, pulling on rigging, hanging flats, sweeping up floors, deep in debt, and still I keep on digging, and I don't get no applause. Hours and hours up fly towers, I'm overworked and underpaid. It's a dangerous game, so I can hardly be to blame if the occasional mistake gets made. Oh, the theatre is an unsafe place.
Yes, the theatre is an unsafe place. That's a piece of wisdom from a show called Tivoli Lovely. It's Eddie Perfect's return to the grand old days before TV, when the home of popular entertainment was Australia's Tivoli Circuit. G'day, I'm Michael Cathcart. Welcome to the stage show here on ABC Radio National. Eddie, you'll know, is a master of entertainment. He's the man who wrote the smash hit musical Beetlejuice. In fact, he's just finished starring in the fabulous Melbourne run of that show. And the director is Dean Bryant, who's brought us a string of entertaining shows as a director and a writer. For example, he wrote the lyrics of the MTC's 2024 hit production of My Brilliant Career, the musical. See, there's one. So let's find out what Tivoli was and what kind of performances it delighted our parents or our grandparents with back in the 1940s and 50s, and why it's time to bring it back. Eddie Perfect and Dean Bryant, welcome to the stage show.
Thank you, Michael.
Hello, Michael.
So nice to have you here. Eddie, the Tivoli, what was it? I've just looked it up in the Macquarie Dictionary and it says it's an entertainment area in Copenhagen.
Well, Tivoli is the name of a theatre, or a theatre circuit, I would say. There were Tivoli theatres across Australia, some of which I think still exist. I think Adelaide's Tivoli Theatre still exists. Melbourne's burnt down. But it really refers kind of colloquially to the circuit that vaudeville performers went on. Tivoli was basically synonymous with Australia's version of vaudeville. You know, America had vaudeville, England had music hall, and we had the Tivoli. And it hung on longer than any other country's vaudeville hung on. I think the Tivoli in Melbourne closed in 1966, which is a good 10 years after television was introduced. And it was the primary sort of form of entertainment. It was marked by extraordinary variety and very niche performances ranging from jugglers, acrobats, mind readers, singers, dancers. They had an orchestra. They had a what they called the ballet corps, which was a dance ensemble. It was singing, dancing, acting, comedy was very big. And Australia had its very own unique flavour of theatre. And it's kind of the building blocks of all kind of contemporary, I think variety, but also low arts, like, you know, stand-up comedy.
I'm old enough to just remember people talking right about the Tivoli, because as you say, it closed in 66. And to my little boyhood mind, it was also a bit racy. There were sort of glamorous showgirls and things.
Yes, and one of the popular, there was a lot of international touring acts that came through. People might remember the Folies Bergère, which was a little bit racy in the day, although there is some speculation that the controversy that particular tour cause was created by the producers of the show. You get a lot away with a lot more in show business back then. You would have topless, what they were called statues, really. They were women with no tops. They weren't allowed to move. That was the thing, you know, it was only lewd if they moved. And so
yes,
you would.
I think they were called tableau vivant.
Tableau vivant.
Living statues, yes.
Yes.
But they weren't allowed to wiggle. Dean?
Yes, Michael?
You love musicals. You write them, you direct them. Is there any Tivoli in your DNA?
I think there's Tivoli in all kind of Australian music theatre writing. Well, I think actually in the sort of more contemporary music theatre writing that's really like taken off at home in the last 10 years, led by Eddie, by Eve Blake, by ourselves, by a lot of cabaret influenced writers, in that, you know, it weaves together. I think what's really interesting about the Australian music theatre that's being formed now is it is irreverent, is that it knows what the music theatre form was from America, but is weaving more of the kind of Tivoli vibe in of work comedy in, work the way Australians really talk in, be funny, don't be too sentimental, but do be sentimental when it counts. So I reckon, yeah, there's a lot of Tivoli in a lot of stuff I've done, even though I wasn't super aware of the Tivoli before this particular rehearsal process.
Actually, as you you say, we also got it from America and from England. The Carol Burnett Show, that TV show, was full of Tivoli acts. I mean, sketch comedy, which was a mainstay of TV in the 60s and early 70s, was a Tivoli form.
Yes, a lot of the Tivoli performers when TV first came in migrated over to television, and I've been really fortunate to read a lot of stuff that's been written about the Tiv. And Tony Sheldon sent me his mum's memoirs, Tony Lamont's memoirs, and she, you know, she very much is a big influence for the writing of the main character in Tivoli Lovely, because, you know, she straddled the crossover between the final days of vaudeville in Australia and the beginnings of television, where, you know, they would give them, you know, 3 hours of airtime and just no direction, just go for it, just fill that time. And it was, by all accounts, an incredibly stressful period of time in television history. But, yeah, for a while, what we would call variety or, you know, well, the TIV migrated to TV.
I suppose it was stressful. I've actually thought it would be rather fun to have been at Channel 7 or Channel 9 in Melbourne, where you were just broadcasting, yeah, the same in Sydney or Perth or Adelaide. The local television station was just broadcasting to that city, and people were just doing stuff on the fly, and they had resident musicians, sometimes an organist playing the Hammond organ, who would be there for the game shows and the night talk show, and yeah, it lived on.
Yeah, well, I mean, it sounds fun, but reading Tony Lamont's memoirs, I was like, it was a lot of pressure and you know, not much support, and no one really knew what was going on, and the gaping hole of 3 hours of live television and, you know, just a couple of feather boas and a drum kit sounds terrifying to me. I think you would find...
On you go.
I think the first, you know, maybe 10 minutes would be fun, and then it would be followed by 2 hours and 50 minutes of abject terror.
I will put that idea out of my head then, that nostalgia for a
no,
job I never
had. I look forward to your 3 hour show. I look forward to it.
That's right. Yes, after I've recited The Man from Snowy River and sung How Much Is That Doggy in the Window Backwards?
Now you're talking.
That's my bag of tricks done. All right, so this is the show. It's called Tivoli Lovely. It's your third major Australian musical following Shane Warne the Musical back in 2008 and Vivid White. I mean, you've done all these other things, but this is an Aussie musical that you've come back to. Now, how does this come about? Whopper is involved in some way. The West Australian Academy of Performing Arts, your old college.
Yes. So, I mean, exciting things are happening at Whopper, and the main thing that's happening is that Whopper is getting a brand new building right in the heart of the city in Yagan Square, this incredible multifaceted facility that also has a brand new theatre attached to it, and Whopper, the whole of Western Australian Academy of Performing Arts, will be moving there next year. So the idea was that 3 years ago the college approached me and said, you know, we're opening a new campus with a new theatre and we would like a new Australian musical to open it. And so the idea of writing a new theatre piece about the history of our theatre that honoured and celebrated the history of our theatre seemed like a really good fit. But, you know, as these things happen with building and construction, the new theatre is not quite ready yet. So we're doing it in the Heath Ledger, which is the State Theatre here in Perth, an absolutely beautiful, beautiful venue.
And just across the road.
Yeah, just across the road. And we started with the cohort that are now playing all the lead roles, the 20 students of the graduating class of 2025. We started with them when they were in first year, and we've been workshopping with them for 3 years, so over the entire period of their college education here. And so we have 20 of them on stage. We have 20 of the second years playing smaller roles and ensemble roles. So we have 40 people on stage, and it's a it's essentially a dance musical, and not just a dance musical, it's a musical about dancers and actors and performers, and it's a big love letter to our theatrical Australian history that I feel like has been, you know, is in danger of being lost because it's pre-digital.
And the skills that those Whopper students have been learning over the last 3 years, have they been the same kind of skills that you and Dean learned when you were there, or has it been tailored towards this production?
No, in fact, I think it's really important what we're doing, because Dean and I are both very passionate about emboldening a sort of a landscape in Australia where more original musicals are created. And to do that, you need performers that aren't just about how to make pre-existing words and music and lyrics and dialogue that comes out of a box from America work on stage. It's about having actors who are able to be adaptable, to learn, to change, to take new songs, to take new scenes, and to think dramaturgically as they're going along and create characters on the fly. It takes a really sort of supple, bold, courageous performer. And we're running these rooms like we would run a professional room. Mm. Yeah.
Dean, I've noticed with music theatre students that they reach for the American accent almost instantly. They sort of dream of Broadway and that they can, you know, be surrogate Americans. Do you think that's true, or am I imposing that on them?
I think you're partially imposing. I don't think it's that they want to be Americans, and I certainly don't think that that's what they want to be right this second in time. But I think it's that we all grow up doing at high school, really everyone gets put into any form of the live performing arts through high school musicals. And of course, you perform the classics in high school. You'll do the Guys and Dolls, you'll do the all of that, you know, that century of fantastic work. And I think you just start to, I've actually noticed it amongst all people, that because they watch so much American television, they think acting is American. That's just like, if you act, you just put on an American accent. Yes. And then you have to wean them off that and go, no, we actually talk like ourselves a lot of the time. And you just don't get that many opportunities, although more and more lately, to do it in Australia. So you actually have to keep reminding people that we are ourselves on stage. We are characters, but we are using our own voice. But I have to say, what's really difficult about Tivoli Lovely is because the rhythms are so vaudeville, people are like, but how do I apply an Australian accent to this kind of, you want me to act as if I'm in Guys and Dolls, but you absolutely won't let me use an American accent. So finding how to lift the Australian vernacular to the style we're doing has been a really interesting challenge for the students.
Yeah, it's incredible we're still talking about this. I mean, it was an issue in the 1970s and we're still wrestling with it.
Well, it's across all art forms though, isn't it? Yeah. You know, you think about contemporary music, people sing in an American accent.
They do.
Country music sing in an American accent. You know, we are still in the process of trying to distill down a kind of a sung vocal Australian sound that is acceptable, and it's a bit of a process. But, you know, musical theatre is by and large, a received culture. We import our musicals. It takes a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of skill to make musicals. And yes, we are making our own musicals, but it is less common than, say, in a city where the art form was born, like New York. And so naturally, a performer can go through their career and not have the experience of what it is to be a collaborator inside the room of a new musical. And I think it's really important at a training institution like WAPA to start turning young people's consciousness towards that idea. It's not that they will go out into the world necessarily and make a million Australian musicals, but they might write musicals, they might produce musicals, they might direct them, you know. You never know where actors are going to end up. It's just about flexing those muscles.
Can't see your hand in front of your face. The theatre is an unsafe place. Trapdoors and ropes and rigging and sets flying at breakneck pace.
These are our villains. Every good show needs a villain, and we have three of them. And, you know, I don't want to give too many spoilers away because the show is predicated on an absolutely ludicrous plot, as all good dance musicals are, I should add.
Keep doors open. It's like crawling over broken glass. It's probably best for me to feather my nest, but first I better cover.
This is where Kevin Daddy Watkins, who's the leader of a Tivoli conquering dance act called the 11 Kevins, has teamed up with the producer, Harriet Miller, and the head of mechanics and rigging, a very strikingly masculine-looking woman called Bridget, to devise a plan, an evil plan, and that's this song.
So there you go, the sounds of vaudeville brought back to life, performed by who, Dean?
Performed by Sebastian Cruz, Kimberly Rose and Olivia Chatto.
In that number, which is called
Theatre is an Unsafe Place.
From Tivoli Lovely. Tell me about Little Miss Evelyn McKay, the girl with the smile.
Yeah. I've had this extraordinary time researching this show, and one of the angels of research on this was Elaine Mariner, the great Elaine Mariner of, you know, Mariner Theatres in Australia. And in the roof of the Princess Theatre, she has this extraordinary performing arts kind of library. And it's
like a magical room. I've been
there. It's so good. And
it's like a mad captain's cabin on a sailing ship.
It's so great. You know, and one day out of nowhere, I left my house, and on my front doorstep, there was one of those big white polystyrene boxes used for transporting frozen fish. And it had been clean, but it was full of some extra stuff that Elaine had found, programs, some memoirs, Roy Reen, extraordinary stuff. And I was reading through all the programs, just trying to get my head around what a night in the Tivoli would have been. And one of the things that shocked me was the show would have had to have been at least 3 hours long. And they performed twice a day, 6 days a week. So that's 6 hours of performing every single day, except for Monday. Mm. And I happened across a lot of different acts, and I was like, what is this act? You know, there were juggling acts, you know, human balancing acts, animal acts, child acts. And one of the child acts was an import from the United States, Little Miss Evelyn McKay, the girl with the smile. And I was like, what is her act? Like, what does she do? I was like, I'm obsessed with this. And I put her in the show. She has her own little song called I'm Always Smiling. And it turns out it's she has no choice. Her face is stuck in a permanent grin. So that's what Miss Evelyn McKay is in Tivoli Lovely.
I did a newspaper search for Miss Evelyn McKay to see if I could track her down. Couldn't find a thing.
Wow. So that's good. I'm glad you couldn't find a thing. That means my version's going to be the right version.
You're writing history. Dean, have you discovered old-time vaudeville acts from the process of being involved in this? People that have tickled your fancy?
Well, I was basically, Eddie put a whole lot of acts through it, which may or may not be true, but I just had to take it upon myself to put them on stage. So we've got Buster Bryson and the Penrith Pooches, which is a couple of students working puppet dogs doing tricks. We've got Adelaidean gymnastics, gymnasts called the Bondolucci Brothers.
Yeah.
And everything else is a kind of performance act, but
Leonard Haval.
Oh, I forgot about the Seal.
How could you forget about the Seal?
The Seal is currently a work in progress. We'll see by opening night if the Seal is still in the show, because right now it is not sealing the deal.
These 11 Kevins of which you spoke earlier, Eddie.
Yeah.
Is this right? Yeah. One of the Kevins is eliminated in some way from the lineup, so there are no longer 11 Kevins.
That's right. I mean, the central idea of the plot, this Tivoli Lovely takes place in two time periods, and it's essentially like a kind of an Arabian Nights type scenario where we have a 85-year-old ex-Tivoli showgirl who is telling her story to a troubled young teenager who was the same age that she was when she first entered the Tiv. And over the course of many nights and days, she tells this story and it comes to life and their friendship grows. And it's a story, it's a pretty extraordinary story of love and murder in the Tiv. And it all begins when the 11 Kevins, right when vaudeville's sort of dying and audiences are thinning out and people are migrating towards cinema and television, there's a on-stage accident and one of the Kevins is accidentally killed. And the rod that Kevin Daddy Watkins has made for his back with this act is the rules are to be in the Kevins, you have to be the greatest dancer alive, and your name, first, middle, or surname, somewhere legitimately with backed up evidence from a birth certificate, has to be Kevin. There's no getting around that. So when they can't find another Kevin, they come across a kind of a nefarious plot to murder people. So that's the premise of it, which is, yeah.
Delicious.
It's delicious. And it rhymes.
This is The State Show on ABC Radio National, and you're meeting Eddie Perfect and Dean Bryant, and we're talking about their new show, which they're putting together with students from WAPA. It's called Tivoli Lovely. Dean Bryant, can I ask you about something else? You've just become the artistic director of the Malthouse Theatre.
I certainly have.
Yeah, which is just down the road from the ABC studios in Melbourne. What can we look forward to at the Malthouse? What's the dream?
Obviously, it's to get Tivoli Lovely on at the Malthouse. It actually is, though, to capture a sort of theatre that Tivoli Lovely is an example of, which is not a musical necessarily, but something that has a boldness, that has an irreverence, that feels like it really speaks to our culture, who we are. I mean, we have come from many different cultures in this country. but to actually get a real liveness into the Malthouse, a sense of like, this is theatre that knows it's theatre, that's very visceral, that has life force, that really likes to engage back and forth with the audience, that makes us laugh, that makes us think, that makes us feel things. That's kind of the interesting, that's the theatre I'm interested in looking for when I start programming 2027.
That sounds exciting. And Eddie, what have you got planned?
Oh, I'm not doing anything. No.
Well, that's a joke.
2025 has been a very busy year. It's been a very public-facing year, which is great, but saps a lot of energy out of me. So I've got some stuff to write. The delicious thing about Tivoli Lovely here at Whopper is that the whole thing is designed to be a means of development of a new work. So it's not the end, it's part of an ongoing process, and I would like to continue to develop it once we've put it on its feet at the Heath Ledger and had a look at it and seen what it is and what audiences are responding to and what they're not. For me, it's the most sort of ambitious structurally in terms of anything I've ever written. Trying to get you learn a lot about a show when you put it in front of an audience that you can't just by doing a workshop. You just see it with fresh eyes, and it's a really important part of it. So, you know, we've done that. They do that on Broadway. You do out-of-town trials. So that's what this is. And, you know, I have a slate of shows that I'm writing, and they're all kind of coming along, but I don't have any performing. So I'm looking forward to sort of, you know, being the writer version of myself and, you know, and to be a dad and to be around and to be home and to walk the dog and all those things that are very boring that I enjoy doing.
Well, chuggers for this. It just sounds marvellous. I wish I could be there. It's just the very kind of thing I love. Eddie Perfect and Dean Bryant, thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael.
Eddie Perfect and Dean Bryant there. And you can see their show, Tivoli Lovely, at Perth's Heath Ledger Theatre between the 7th and the 14th of November. Bookings for this through the WA Arts and Culture Trust, and it's supported by the Mindaroo Foundation, run by Andrew and Nicola Forrest. On ABC Radio National, you're letting your hair down on The Stage Show with Michael Cathcart. As we approach Halloween, dancers, choreographers and academics are gathering in Naarm, Melbourne, for a special symposium titled Haunted, Tracing the Spectral in Australian Ballet. I wonder if they'll be wearing pointy hats. These people, these scholars, are giving all kinds of papers, from the weird and wacky to studies of historical costumes and our haunted histories. Yvette Grant is a PhD researcher at the Victorian College of the Arts, and she's one of the conference organisers. You've heard her on the stage show before. Hello, Yvette.
Hi, Michael.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Do we say happy Halloween? What do we say? Or horrendous Halloween? Horrible Halloween?
Probably all of the above.
Ooh. I used to be a bit snotty about Halloween, think it was a terrible American commercial imposition on our wonderful Australian culture.
Yeah, so when we were deciding to do this conference and decided to call it Haunted, we thought Halloween, it had to be Halloween, right?
Yeah. I've changed my mind now. I think it's cute, all these kids running around playing trick or treat. I feel like I've been a grumpy old man all these years, and I've decided to stop it. So the conference is called Haunted, Tracing the Spectral in Australasian Ballet. The spectral means ghostly stuff. Are ghosts a distinctive feature of ballet generally?
Well, we sort of wanted to keep the scope open for this symposium. So there was a whole list of ways in which you could interpret that, and we've got all of them. So, I mean, Giselle would be an obvious one for the spectral in ballet, in
yes,
a ballet.
Yes, the ghosts of women who've died before they get married.
Yeah. But we're also focusing on ballets that are ghosts, that we don't see actively, that are haunting the archives. Or ghosts that are still haunting us in the ballet studio. So they're sort of sitting on our shoulders, telling us how we have to be.
Our forebears.
Yes. And we wanted to ask, you know, how useful are these ghosts?
Point your toes, the ghosts are saying in your ears.
Well, they say, you know, you have to be like this. Or maybe they say, I guess the question is, are they friendly ghosts like Casper? Right. Do we want to bring them along for the ride? Or is it time to exorcise some of these ghosts?
So I've got the program here for the symposium on the 31st of October, Halloween. And you're here, you're on at 9:15. on Halloween morn.
Very early, isn't it?
I know. It
doesn't seem very early especially.
So yours is called, Yvette Grant, that's you, A Triple Haunting, Valerine Tweedy's 1957 ballet, Wakuka?
Wakuka, yes.
Wakuka. All right. So tell us about Valerine, not Valerie, Valerine Tweedy. Who's she?
She's got an incredible story. She was born in 1925, started doing ballet. When the Ballet Russe came, they needed some people to fill in, and she happened to get called up. So she...
They were touring, were they?
They were touring Australia, yes. So she was flown down to Melbourne from Sydney and filled in. And she said she was just thrown on stage and basically had to copy what they were doing. But once the dancers worked out that she was there, they started taking more days off, so she got to do more dancing. And by the time they left, they invited her to go with them. So she was 15 years old, she got on a steamship, and off she went to the Americas with the Ballet Russe.
And she changed her name from Valerine Tweedy to Irina Lavrova.
Oh, yes, that's right. She was for a long time. Until the end of her stay, actually, right. When she was allowed to take her own name back, yes.
Oh, seems very...
They all had to change their names to right? Russian names.
Gosh.
Yes.
And then Valerine also works with George Balanchine, the famous choreographer in the USA.
That's right. So she does a couple of tours with the Ballet Russe through the US, and she gets to dance with choreographers like George Balanchine, who is considered sort of the American ballet choreographer. He sort of, like, he came up with the American style. A lot of people consider that to be the case. And she dances with Agnes DeMille in her ballet Rodeo.
You talk as though we all know what that is. What is that?
Yes, so it's about a rodeo, and it's about a woman.
Oh, the ballet's called Rodeo, okay.
Yeah, it's about a woman is the key character, and she wants to be a cowgirl. She doesn't want to be one of the girls who just turns up in a pretty dress at the dance. She wants to be like one of the boys. Anyway, the story sort of goes along those lines, but it is set on a ranch, I guess.
There'd be a lot of falling over in that ballet.
But it's a wonderful ballet. The movement is extraordinarily modern, and their bodies become like part of the horse. But she also dances.
This is an extraordinary story. She's 14. She's born in Sydney. She leaves Sydney in the 30s and goes off and has this kind of global career.
Yes.
And then at 17, gosh, she got off to an early start. At 17, she married a Cuban dancer.
She did.
And went to live in Havana.
She did. They married in Buenos Aires, and because of the war, his family said, "We think it's best if you come back to Cuba." And so she went back to Havana, and this was actually, she coincides with the time and meets Alicia Alonso.
Who
she becomes the longtime director of the National Cuban Ballet. So Valerine Tweedy's right there at the inception of that company when Alonso is still really just thinking about it. And Alonso's going off to...
But she becomes a big name, does she,
very
in Cuba?
Big name. And she dances into her 90s. Oh. She's very long-lived. And so Valerine Tweedy is there, and she works with all of these American choreographers who are looking for an American style of ballet. She works with Alonso, who's looking for a Cuban style of ballet.
Ah, I see where you're going.
She comes back.
So the idea of national types of ballet.
Yeah, so we're not doing what the Europeans are doing. We're not imitating them anymore.
All the Russians. Everyone can have their own ballet, and she comes back to Oz.
She comes back to Oz, and somebody asks her to make a ballet.
So what does she do?
Well, she'd been out on a family's sheep station.
Yes.
And so she decides to make a ballet set on a sheep station.
Called?
Wakuka.
Wakuka, okay. And what's this about?
The story itself is very simple. Two acts, and it's very similar to Rodeo, actually. The first act is working on the farm, on the station, shearing sheep. Second act is that same evening when everyone comes around for a social dance. And it's a love story. So the key character is the station owner's daughter, and she flirts with the shearers, but the engineer from the Snowy River scheme drops by.
Right.
And he's this kind of ethnic, swarthy man,
right,
professional. And she likes him more.
So this is modernity versus tradition.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to. So my argument with this ballet is that although it's a very simple love story on the surface, it is haunted by its 1957 moment. it reflects in almost documentary style what was going on in 1957 in Australia. So Australia was moving from riding on the sheep's back to this second wave of mining with all of its engineers. Yep. And the first wave of, even though we were deep in White Australia policy, was the first wave of migrants who came out to work on the Snowy River.
Well, we're winding back the White Australia policy, actually, aren't we? We're starting
Yes, just starting, but they were white migrants.
That's true, yes.
Yeah. Now, and also the fact that the station owner's daughter is our central character. She is a young woman. She's sort of like the manager. So she's a professional woman. We never see anyone over 25 in this ballet. This is a ballet about young people.
Now, how do we know this was any good, this ballet?
Well, the first time I saw the 1961 ABC television version, I thought, oh, it's all right. But it took me a while to warm to it.
This is in the archive, is it?
This is in the archive. There is a tiny bit of the 1957 one.
Right.
But I started reading what they'd said in the newspapers about it. And can I quote one of those
for
you?
Yes, you can.
So RR in the Daily Mirror, September 1957, and I quote, says, "Against this intimate background and through this authentic atmosphere, the simple yet lyrically beautiful theme of the ballet Wakuka is danced out. If the summer of the 17th doll portrays the tragic late summer of humanity, this ballet dances and sings with the springtide of youth and love and happiness."
Wow, that's a big call.
Big call.
1956 is when the Summer of the 17th Doll comes out, so we're right in that zone.
Yes, and of course, Summer of the 17th Doll is the first time an Australian accent is heard on stage.
Yeah, maybe.
One of the first times, let's say.
Yeah.
And so comparing it to that is like there's a hint that this is one of the first times or a significant time that we're seeing an Australian accent in ballet on stage.
Very nice.
Perhaps.
Now, what about the Aboriginal sounding name? Is that an issue or is that a factor in all of this?
So, Wakuka. Yes, I would say the composer is John Antill, and when he and Valerine Tweedy got together, she said, "I don't really know what to call this." And he handed her a dictionary of Aboriginal words, which we can only imagine was a very generic.
Yes, I remember this. There was a dictionary that many people had on the mantelpieces that just said an Aboriginal dictionary, and it just had words chosen from random
languages.
Hundreds of languages, and they just botched into this big pile.
And so she chose Wakuka, which means kookaburra singing in the morning. And, of course, the score begins with a kookaburra singing in the morning. We would consider that way of doing things today racist and offensive, and we wouldn't...
Yeah, it's cultural appropriation. That's how things have changed, yeah.
So we've covered the male characters in some ways.
Yeah.
But the other side, so that's sort of... The other side is in the evening when the women start arriving, we have the two chatterboxes turn up for the dance. Women who are probably working and have the ability to engage in buying things and, they're new consumers, and they arrive on their horses, they gallop in. But the next character to arrive is really interesting. She's the sophisticated girl, and she drives a car, and you can only imagine that it's an open top, the way she kind of moves in with a big steering wheel, and they all look at her and she reverses into spot. And she teaches them how to rock and roll.
Mm.
Now, by the 60s, rock and roll is sort of more mainstream and popular. But in 1957, we're talking about the rock and roll riots time. They say that really the first time Australians saw rock and roll was in 1956 in the cinema in September. And Bill Haley and the Comets don't come till 1957. Bandstand doesn't start till 1958. So it was quite radical to put rock and roll on a ballet
stage. It was the next big thing.
Yes. And also, between the engineer and the sophisticated girl, we're really seeing the influence of America on Australia at that time. So this kind of movement away from following everything English to embracing some of what America has to offer.
Yeah, well, the Snowy Mountain Scheme was a sort of vision too of American scale.
Yeah.
I mean, it was influenced by the Great Hoover Dam and all that stuff.
That's right. And I guess the only other, so I called it a triple haunting. Do you want to hear about the third one?
What's the third one?
This was the deepest haunting I felt.
Yeah.
Because there's two other characters I haven't told you about. One is the shy girl, and I was really confused and stumped. Who is this shy girl? Is she bookish? Why is there a shy girl? But there's also the rouseabout, and the rouseabout is sort of the dog's body on the sheep station. The others sort of, they don't include him. Well, they do, but they sort of, he's a bit of an outsider. And I couldn't kind of work out what was going on there until I realised the Rouseabout is an Aboriginal man.
Right.
And then I thought about the Shy Girl, and the Rouseabout dances with the Shy Girl. And of course, the shy Aboriginal woman is also a very common trope. And shyness and muteness was a form of protest for Aboriginal women in domestic service. So we have these two characters not listed as Aboriginal characters, but they most certainly are. They had to be there. You couldn't have a sheep station without Aboriginal workers on it. To find these characters was revelation. I mean, it was an important moment for me.
So I'm just trying to visualise this. You're all going to get together on Halloween. I don't know, you're going to wear funny hats and stuff?
I think that's up for grabs. I think we've got a few student volunteers from Victorian College of the Arts. They might get stuck
into
the
costumes. Come on, the academics have got to be a bit wacky. I hope you're going to have pumpkins and stuff. I mean, this is show business.
Yes, indeed, indeed. There are a few different, like there's a bit of a variety of things going on. We did want to preserve some, the academic part of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's really important.
I'm sure there are listeners who wonder what it is that academics do when they study dance. So what are the kind of topics that an academic can get their teeth into?
I think there's a very broad spectrum.
Give us some examples.
Okay, so for me it's history, but it's history, bringing history back to life. What does it look like if we bring it back now? Other people might explore something much more choreographic. So if they're dancers themselves, they might do a practice-led research project where they're actually in the studio, they try things out on their bodies, they go away and reflect on that, they try it out again, they reflect on that, and then they sort of build up and they read about what other dancers have done. So that's sort of another approach.
Yeah, but that's what dancers do anyway, isn't it?
Yes.
They're just doing it in a sort of university context.
That's right. That's right. And also capturing it for future dancers as well.
Yeah. Yvette Grant is at the VCA, part of the Melbourne Uni. How should we credential you? What do we call you? You're a researcher,
Yeah, I'm a researcher and a dance history tutor.
The symposium is called Haunted, Locating the Spectral in Australian Ballet. And it's happening on the 31st of October at Melbourne Uni. If you want to go along to this, if you're of academic bent and dancing bent, you've got to register for this, don't you? It costs money.
You do, except there is a panel at the end of the day.
Oh.
So we have five extraordinary dancers who are coming to talk to us.
You mean a free panel?
A free panel. Ooh. So from 5:30 to 7 p.m, you still need to register, but it is free. And it should be fabulous.
This is ABC Radio National. You're on The Stage Show with Michael Cathcart. Two lovers meet regularly in secret under a lemon tree out in the countryside. And as these young people's passion grows, strangers are moving ever closer, intruders who threaten everything the lovers are and know. That's the setup for a funny, gut-wrenching play called Whitefella, Yellow Tree by the Palawa playwright Dylan Vandenberg. It had a triumphant run at Sydney's Griffin Theatre back in 2022, and now it's back for seasons at La Boite in Brizzy and at Melbourne Uni at the new theatre complex there. So audiences in those two cities can share the experience. Now, last time you met Dylan here on The Stage Show, we were all confined by the pandemic, and since then Dylan has produced four plays, he's won a heap of awards, and he's working on a doctoral thesis about what he calls Aboriginal Gothic fiction. I'm dying to know what that's all about. Dylan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sounds exhausting. You all right?
I'm tired. I've got two kids as well. So,
oh my lordy lord. So you have been piling up these awards. Your 2021 play, Milk, won the New South Wales Premier's Award, the Victorian Premier's Award for drama, these are, the Canberra Critics Circle Award, and the 2022 Kate Challis Raka Award, which is a very prestigious prize indeed. I mean, that's a massive endorsement for one show. Did that open doors for you, all that acclaim?
Absolutely. I think the main thing it did was prove to me that you don't have to be a genius to be a playwright. I thought for so long you had to be Joanna Murray Smith or Tom Stoppard or Wesley Enoch, but you can be a pleasant oaf like me and still write plays. So there's the proof.
I don't know. Maybe they're just ordinary mortals like you and me, Dylan, once you get to know them. Now, you're about to complete a PhD at ANU. It's called Aboriginal Gothic. So you've been exploring Aboriginal Gothic. What a fabulous term. What does it mean?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think it's kind of characterised in opposition to, you know, the Australian Gothic, which is, I guess, this idea of being terrified of the landscape, of there being mystical figures, being First Nations peoples, you know, lingering in the bush. The Aboriginal Gothic is, I guess, more about the comfort of the landscape for First Nations peoples, that it's not the land that's terrifying to us, but the white ghosts who populate it. And I guess it refers to a style of work that I guess we've identified in other forms of the art. So across novels of Alexis Wright or Kim Scott, for example, in photography and film, but we haven't really thought about it and surveyed it as it kind of manifests on the stage. So I'm trying to identify what the key features of that Aboriginal Gothic on the stage could actually be.
Right. And do you think this work we're talking about now is an example of Aboriginal Gothic?
There are definitely features of it. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, one of them is that there's country as a character, that it's kind of alive and it animates the drama. And I'm sure as we get into the chat, we'll talk about the tree at the centre of the work.
Let's talk about the tree now. So the centre of the play is this tree, which we discover is the lemon tree. It's the yellow tree of the title. And there are these amazing effects because every time these two boys who meet regularly near the tree, every time they sort of look away, the tree grows and it goes... My arboreal impersonation. There's this sort of creaking of roots extending out and increasing their grasp on the land. And it is like something out of Edgar Allan Poe or Wuthering Heights. It's got, you know, that scratching at the window that you get in Wuthering Heights of the trees and Kathy out there in the darkness. It's that kind of territory when this tree starts to menacingly or tantalizingly or seductively or threateningly extend its reach.
Exactly. And, you know, the tree in the play is an introduced tree. It's a lemon tree. It's a stand-in for the colonizer. And so it bears witness to the burgeoning love story between these two boys, but it also poisons the earth around them and infects their country. So as it kind of grows and gains strength, it, you know, puts a divide between the boys and their mobs as well.
Yeah. So there are two boys, young men, Ty and Neddy. Neddy is... Well, you tell us. He's from the Mountain Mob, yep.
That is from Mountain Mob. He's a wannabe warrior. He's strong. He's quick. He fancies himself as quick. And he sees himself on a path to being a warrior and heading out there and, you know, taking on the white fellas.
Yeah, a bit of a scaredy cat, though, when it comes down to it, doesn't he?
He is. He's kind of, you know, hiding behind this sense of bravado. And he's completely opposite of Ty. Ty's a storyteller, a knowledge holder, and he's being, I guess, trained up to play those roles in his community by his elders. So they couldn't be more different, these two boys.
His elders are down at the River Mob.
That's right.
This is what's so lovely. Neddy comes down from the mountains and Ty comes up from the river, and they meet at this place midway between the two to exchange information. Basically, they're a kind of message service between the elders.
Mm-hmm. That's right. They're there to reveal what they've witnessed from the white fellas, what they've seen them doing, what new information they've been able to glean from, I guess, hiding out in the mountains or down by the river and keeping watch on the white fellas who've just arrived.
Well, here's a scene from early on. The two boys, Neddy and Ty, are at their meeting place, exchanging information, as we're saying, from their respective mobs.
I know you're there. You can come out. I'm not dumb. I know you're there.
Oi, what the?
Sooner you get your ass out here, sooner I can leave.
Chucking rocks like a
what?
Say sorry.
What?
For chucking the rock.
Sorry. Wish I found a bigger one. Could have knocked you out cold, left you here for the birds. Where you been?
Been sneaking, haven't I? Hang on. What's your code name?
Seriously?
Told you before. Arrive at the tree, announce yourself. But with your code name, then...
Shut up, Neddy.
Oi, no real names around
sorry,
here.
Sorry, Neddy. Oh, whoopsie.
You better pull your head in before I come over there and biff your nose.
Scary.
Ah, just give me your code name.
Are you 15 or 5?
Code name.
I don't remember.
Don't remember. Pretty important.
Well, what's yours?
Feisty Fish.
Because you're tough and slippery?
Yeah. No, feisty as in like, you know.
I don't.
And fish as in like...
Cold-blooded?
No.
You don't have eyelids.
Fish as in like quick... Now, your turn. I'm not coming out for just anyone.
You know who I am?
Code name. Starts with S.
Slinky?
Nah.
Sneaky?
No,
saucy?
No,
stylish?
No.
Super slick?
No!
I don't know.
Oh, it's silent. Silent Moth.
Yeah, I'm picking something else.
You can't just change your code name.
I don't remember coming to any kind of agreement.
You got a better idea?
I'll stick with the moth.
Good. I reckon you are who you say you are. My name's Nettie. Code name, Feisty Fish. I'm Mountain Mob. Here to exchange information on about the white fellas.
My name's Ty. Code name, Silent Moth. River Mob. Now, can we just get this done? I don't fancy walking back in the dark.
Okay.
Okay.
That's Joseph Althaus as Ty and Danny Howard as Nettie in that scene from White Fella Yellow Tree by Dylan Vandenberg, with seasons coming up in Brisbane and in Melbourne. What both groups, the mountain people and the river people, are struggling with is that these white people are moving onto their country. And Ty's saying, okay, they smell awful. That's what he's learned. And he reckons that his mob know what some of these white people's words mean. Then Nettie has a go at exchanging information on behalf of the mountain mob. And then after they do that exchange of information, they sort of notice the tree. And this is when the tenderness, all that, you know, bravado starts to melt away, and they smell the flowers and they taste the fruit, and they're joking opens a door between them to another way of relating to one another.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. They notice that the tree can be a thing of beauty as well as of wonder and mystery. And it really is, I guess, the gateway into their relationship. It's under the guise of, you know, Nettie wanting to take flowers back home to his sister. But what it does is, I guess, unlock their mutual affection for one another, even if they're not quite able to pinpoint it.
Now, this is a staggeringly tightly structured play, Dylan. It's 1.5 hours long, pretty much exactly. And it has 3 30-minute sections, pretty much exactly. And the first 30-minute section is funny and loving, and you know they're sort of tantalised by what these white people might bring. It's not all hostility. It's kind of, who are they? You know, they stink. They love those little clouds, which are sheep. You know, that's a bit weird. But you know, they're kind of interested. And then in part two, the whites are taking over, and they've taken Nettie's sister. And then it gets complicated. And then in part three, Nettie returns after 2 years away. And can we say this? Can I say this, that he's wearing the king's uniform?
Of course. Yeah, yeah.
Because that's the challenge, isn't it? What's astonishing about this play is that you've given a character I don't reckon we've seen on the stage ever. I can't remember seeing this before. And that is of the Aboriginal person who is drawn, powerless, I guess, but who's drawn into a collaboration. Is that the word?
Yeah, I think a kind of collaboration, yeah.
With the white colonisers, but at a cost. And the cost is really what your play is about. So talk to me about
yes.
that cost.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, in the context of the play, Nettie's sister is gone, as you've said, and he decides to go and find her. And he goes against his elders' orders, and he leaves. He leaves his community, and he slowly worked his way into the white fella camps by offering help, by supporting them. I'm assuming in real life he would have been a tracker for them, I imagine. All of this, in the service of finding his sister. But slowly, you know, living with the white fellas, it's more comfortable. Food's more readily accessible. You're protected in so many ways. And in some ways, Nettie begins to, I guess, compromise on his relationship with Ty, on his relationship to his own community. And I think in the end, begins to deceive himself around his reasons for being there to start.
And Ty's really hurt because he's been waiting for 2 years for him to come back. And these men are in love.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I think we're all of us are able to kind of delude ourselves sometimes, and Nettie's going through an absolute delusion that he's going to find his sister, that he's with the white fellas in order to do that. And I think it's deeply but painful for him to be away from Ty as well. And more painful, I think, when he does return to realise that, you know, Ty doesn't necessarily want to see his face ever again.
So, Dylan, is it fair to say that the politics of this play for you is about the way in which the white culture vilifies the love between these two men so that they can no longer love each other openly if they were to go onto the white side together?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really about diagnosing the point at which homophobia landed in what we call Australia. Relationships between, same-sex couples in First Nations communities have been erased from history through a white lens. There's this idea that First Nations communities are heteronormative and so on. And so really this play is about how there was a place for queerness within our First Nations communities for thousands and thousands of years, and that when the boats hit the shore, they introduced, you know, religion, Western morality and ideas of, you know, who should and shouldn't be together.
And this is a well-established fact, is it, about Indigenous communities, First Nation communities? I mean, was this universal, do you know, this openness?
I only know from research and chatting with people from some mobs, and of course there's huge diversity across Australia in mobs and so on, but it's definitely well documented, particularly up in the top end, the Torres Strait, brother boys and sister girls, and we know that there was a lot of openness and queerness was welcomed and celebrated, and that people had roles that they could actually play within the community. So it is documented, and the stories that do exist and made their way and trickle down through to now demonstrate that.
Yeah, the heartbreak in the play is the way in which Neddy, he's the warrior one, the one with all the strut, the one with the great muscles and everything, he disowns his own sexuality, doesn't he? In the end, he's been undermined, I suppose, by the Christian doctrine on this.
Yeah, it's something I write about a lot. I mean, the arrival of Christianity has impacted Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples across the board. There are a lot of, you know, religious First Nations folks today, and I think it had a huge part to play in homophobia that continues to play out in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities as well.
That's such a complex story, isn't it? The interaction of the Christian missionaries, especially, and First Nations people. It's got complexities and twists and turns to it.
Yeah, and I sometimes imagine what it must have been like to try and integrate your own cosmology, your own belief system with a new one that's being forced upon you, and trying to find a way to navigate the two existing at once, and eventually, you know, needing to make a decision.
I think there are people on both sides of the frontier who felt that. There are missionaries who see the depth of what Aboriginal spirituality is.
Absolutely. Who could recognise that it had, you know, played a huge part in the daily lives, and was a huge part of, you know, making sense of the invaders and you know what they did after that.
Now, Dylan, the design is wonderful for that production at Griffin, that little theatre with its weird shaped triangular shaped space. But now you're going to more conventionally shaped theatres. Is it going to be the same design? Does it adapt nicely for the theatres you'll be working in Brisbane and in Melbourne?
Great question. So Mason Brown's beautiful design has been, we've kept it, and we've been able to kind of expand it slightly for the bigger spaces. So we did just finish up a season at Sydney Theatre Company before we head up to La Boite and then down to Melbourne. And so we've been able to keep the tree, to keep the mountains in the background, but just to open it up and expand it a little bit for the non-Griffin weird kite-shaped spaces that we're moving into.
It's actually a beautiful use of the Griffin space, isn't it? I really think that's one of the most marvelous sets I've ever seen in that space. It really worked well.
When I asked the designer for a tree in the middle of Griffin Theatre, I think.
For those of you who haven't been to Griffin, it's a tiny little space, and the acting space is shaped like a wedge of cake. You know, it's wide at one end and narrow at the other, and the audiences are sitting on both sides. So it's very intimate, and it produces an extraordinary dynamic between the actors and the audience. Now, look, last month you won the Australian Theatre Festival NYC New Play Award for The Flood.
Oh, yes.
What is this award? What's the play? Tell me all about this.
Of course. The Flood is a play for younger audiences set in a dystopian future. There's no water left in the world in Australia, but they've been promised by the government that there's a flood coming that's going to fix everything, rejuvenate the earth around them. So that's the play. And one girl embarks on a journey out into country to try and solve it in order to save her family and sister and community. And so I had the opportunity to go to New York a couple of weeks ago. I got back to spend time at the Australian Theatre Festival, meet with the wonderful organisers over there, and I guess, celebrate the work and chat with people about potential opportunities for the work.
Dylan Vandenberg there, and his play is White Fella Yellow Tree. It's produced by Griffin Theatre Company, directed by Declan Green and Amy Soule, and you can see it at
Brisbane's La Boite until the 8th of November. And then it's heading to Melbourne for three nights at the University of Melbourne, where the new Arts and Culture Centre is called UMAC. And that's from the 13th to the 15th of November. Well, that's us done for another week. The Stage Show is produced for you by Rosa Ellen. It's always great to have your company. I'm Michael Cathcart. I'll see you next time we talk about theatre. Bye now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.